Support for the All Sides with Ann Fisher podcast comes from Wolf's Ridge Brewing, a family-owned Columbus brewery and restaurant, offering home beer delivery and curbside food pickup Tuesday through Sunday. More at wolfsridgebrewing.com.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. More than 38 million people around the world have been infected by COVID-19. More than a million have died. Scientists are studying the virus at an unprecedented pace. And yes, their knowledge base has grown since March, but there's still much that is unknown. Health experts warn that the threat will worsen as colder weather drives people inside and many families gather for the upcoming holidays. We already are hearing about the shutdowns afoot in Europe. Although promises of a quick vaccine fix persist, early trials have hit the usual obstacles. So who do we bring in to answer our questions at such times like these? Frederick Bertley, president and CEO of COSI. He also has a doctorate in immunology. He's worked internationally in preventative medicine and basic vaccines. At Harvard Medical School, he helped develop DNA vaccines for HIV/AIDS. Welcome back to the show.
Good to be here, and thanks so much for having me on.
When you were on in August, scientists were trying to piece together some of the mysteries of the virus. So mysteries about how it spread, mysteries about what it does. It seems like we're still learning a lot about what the virus does to us.
Absolutely. I mean, and this is the first time in recorded history that we're really, I mean, with the exception of, I guess, HIV from 1981 onward, where we really get to study in real time what's happening with this virus. And so, you know, I mean, what we thought of, we knew in January, February, clearly has been turned on its head, and it continues to evolve. And primarily several reasons, several areas. One, how is it people are specifically getting sick? Why is it some people get infected and are asymptomatic, whereas others get infected and get mildly sick versus others who progress? There's no clear codification yet as to what's happening from an immune response standpoint. And then the other piece is, when we look about the people who recover, what aspects of the immune response are making that difference to allow some people to recover faster versus others progress on to be really ill? And then thirdly, and I know we're gonna talk about this later, from a vaccine development standpoint, you know, we're kind of shooting in the dark in terms of what specific aspects of the immune system do we need to stimulate through a vaccine that's going to ensure a rapid recovery or a prevention from someone being infected by the virus. So there's all these unknowns. And then, of course, the age of the kids. Are kids infectious? How does that look? Oh, they weren't going to be infected. Now they can carry it. I mean, there's so many unknowns. But the good news is we know a lot more today than we did back in February.
Yeah, the treatments are improving, right?
Absolutely. I mean, there are 22 different coronavirus treatments in some type of level of testing, and two are really promising. Two of the three that our president received are actually very promising. So treatment, it's getting better and better. I want to be clear, we're still not there yet. In the case of HIV, we have a great treatment for that. We don't have a vaccine yet, but if you unfortunately get HIV, you can take one or two pills a day and you can live an almost completely normal life. We're not there yet at all with coronavirus.
With HIV, it's a bloodborne disease. With the flu pandemic of 1918, was that a coronavirus?
That's right. It was an early type of coronavirus.
Okay.
And so the flu type virus, which again is aerosolated, but then gets into your through your blood and through your lymphatic tissues and spreads.
Now, a lot of us learned from watching Downton Abbey that because a lot of us didn't grow up learning a lot about that pandemic, but that some people could get that and some people could be completely at least symptom free.
A very important point for people to remember is there's 7.7 billion people on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And our immune system is our defense system to prevent us from being hurt or harmed by the hundreds of thousands of stuff we see every day. And in our lifetime, the millions and millions of different antigens or threats that our body gets exposed to. The point is, our immune systems have a lot of overlap, but no two immune systems, with the exception of possibly identical twins, and that can also depend if they were separated and where they were raised,
mm-hmm.
No two people have the same immune system. So in any given pandemic, in any given outbreak, in any given infectious situation, some people may be not infected at all, Some people maybe get infected but not get sick, and other people can get mildly sick, and other people can crash and burn really fast. And it's because we're all different. It's not a cop-out answer. It's a scientifically backed truth that our immune systems, while there's a lot of overlap to cover the basic stuff, there are also differences at the edges, and that could determine, you know, getting sick, whether it's the Spanish flu back in the early in the early 1900s or what we're experiencing now.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking to Frederick Bertley, president and CEO of COSI, but he also holds a PhD in immunology. He worked internationally in preventative medicine and basic vaccines. And we're taking your questions today, listener. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Or email us at allsides@wosu.org. If you want to go to the Facebook, go to the All Sides Facebook page and post your questions there. Again, my guest is Frederick Bertley, better known as president and CEO of COSI, but he also holds a PhD in immunology, and he's joined us a couple times since the outbreak to talk about what we're learning. Now, we're hearing about Europe is starting to shut down again. They've put a curfew in place in Paris, and Spain is talking about shutting down restaurants and bars. What is this telling you? This is the kind of stuff that we talked about in the spring that was predicted to happen.
Absolutely. And we just need to be clear. None of this is surprising. You know, the virus is not political. The virus has no opinion. It has one function, and that's to replicate, and it does that by infecting us humans. That's it. And so while we all have absolutely all the right intentions and want to live a normal life, the fact of the matter is, if we aggregate, if we connect with people, if we're not wearing masks, if we're not social distancing, we're going to continue to not just spread the virus, but have elevated infectious rates that you see. I mean, Europe has the highest rates they've ever seen. And U.S., many states have hit their highest rates they've ever seen. And it's just because, you know, of the will and the want and desire to get out there and have the somewhat normal life. But you just got to be very careful. But it's not surprising to anybody. And Europe is just like at the beginning of this pandemic, Europe is a precursor to what's going to continue to happen in the U.S.
Right. So knowing what we know now about the outbreaks that are occurring in Europe at this point, what did we learn in the spring about when we can expect the surge again in the United States? Is there any way to know?
I mean, it's you just got to follow the map and do a kind of two-week follow-up on any place where we're aggregating. So if you're doing events, whether it's sporting events that weren't in the bubble, the NBA proved the bubble could really work, which was fascinating. Mm-hmm. But if we're doing sporting events, if we're doing gatherings, whether it's campaign trails, whether it's your barbecues over Thanksgiving or whatever, if you're gathering, count anywhere from 10 to 14 days after that, you're going to see spikes. That we know is true. Now, the good news is we also know social distancing and wearing masks really does help. So if you are just compelled to be part of a gathering, ensure that you and the guests are socially distant. I mean, you know, the analogy I like to use is bumper cars. Most of us have driven bumper cars, at least people my age and older. I know younger folks don't know what that is. But if you've ever driven a bumper car, you know the arena where the bumper cars are. Imagine there's only two bumper cars in that whole arena. Well, it'd be so hard to navigate through that space to hit that second bumper car versus 30 bumper cars in that same geographic space, right? And now you're bumping into people. That's what you got to think about when you think about why social distancing is important. You want to be far from people and you want to wear a mask.
The New York Times had a story that nearly one in three COVID-19 patients had altered mental state. Is that something that's relevant because it's going, this altered state is persisting beyond the other symptoms?
That's an interesting point. What we need to look at is coronavirus-induced neuropathy or coronavirus-induced cognitive impairment and what that could look like. But you can't subtract, or we have to subtract out, the pandemic itself, right? I mean, I bet you if you do a study on regular people who aren't infected by coronavirus but are living through this pandemic, you'll probably get one out of three people having some type of mental issues because it's depressing. We know mm-hmm. suicide rates are up. We know domestic abuse is up. We know alcoholism and drug use is up. So, you know, how do you tease out specifically, was it because they were infected or we are just really in a troubling, difficult time that does have a significant mental impact on how we are?
So it's not in a vacuum then, and to really understand those numbers, we would have to suss out people that are just having mental impairment anyway.
Yeah. Now, and to be clear, and I haven't read that study, so I have to go back and read that New York Times unpublished study. But to be clear, you know, the people who are doing the study are hopefully going to have a controlled environment. But it's safe to say that, you know, the whole pandemic has had a definitive impact on our cognition and our mental health. And so just making sure we're mindful to not go out there and right away say that, oh, if you get coronavirus, you know, one out of three people are going to have serious mental issues that are not recoverable. We got to take it with the bigger issues of the pandemic.
There was just the first confirmed case of reinfection of an American in Nevada. What does that development tell us about immunity? Now, we have heard about this in other places, just not in the U.S. yet.
Yeah. And again, U.S., like everything else, is following China and following other places. And yes, we finally have our reinfection. And what that tells you is two things. One, and we actually started doing this, the virus actually mutates a lot faster than we initially thought. So there are different strains within the overall strain of coronavirus that are floating around now in our ecosystems. Mm. Secondly, it tells you that the immunity, and again, we're not definitive on what the immunity provides, but normally, if you get infected with something, it's one thing if it's 10 years from now or 20 years from now or 80 years from now, but if you just got infected from something a few months ago, you should normally have protective immunity to that same thing. So either the immune system, your antibodies that you developed from that first infection, and what's called your T-cell immunity that protects you as well, it's not perfect, so that when you got exposed to coronavirus but a slightly different strain, that immunity you had either just disappeared and faded fast or is there, but because the virus is mutated, it's not useful.
And you shouldn't assume whatever your physical response, if you've been tested positive for COVID-19, you shouldn't assume that whatever symptoms you had with that version of it is necessarily going to be the same if you catch it again, whatever again means.
Absolutely. That's a great point. You know, first of all, if you had it, doesn't mean you're protected for life. We don't know that yet. And two, if you get tested again and the first time you were breezy with it, even though you're positive, don't assume you'll necessarily be breezy. Definitely take the precautions and make sure, you know, you're following up with your healthcare officials.
Schools are back in session. I was wondering what your observations are about that, at least in Central Ohio.
Yeah, I mean, we've been hitting some staggering numbers. I think we're up to, America, almost 600 new cases of coronavirus infections have happened in our schools throughout Ohio. And two counties that are impacted really badly are our county, Franklin County, right here. And it's really tough because you want, obviously, schools to open, but schools are incubators, right? And one of the big things with schools, and especially a lot of the old buildings, is they don't necessarily have the best circulatory systems in terms of ventilation systems and having clean and purified air and having mechanisms to make sure you sterilize the air. And so you bring in kids who, just by nature of being kids, have a tough time social distancing. And now you have adults there, and they're in the classrooms, but then they go back at home, and then they come back into the classrooms. You know, it's just really challenging. It's unfortunate. Again, the recipe is, in a perfect universe where we didn't have to live our lives, we would just stay home. But, you know, kids' education are paramount, and homeschooling is people choose to do that. But there is, you know, obviously there's so many benefits of trying to be in school in person. But, you know, we got to think of the long haul. And at the end of the day, what we're going to see, and you talked about this in your opening remarks, is as we go through the holiday period and into January and February, there's going to be continual increased levels of infection because schools are opening up in the K-12 space, blended or otherwise, and universities have opened. And then when the holiday seasons hit, they go back to their respective communities. And so, you know, it's really tough, but for sure, we're just going to continue seeing elevations in school infections, for sure.
We are talking about COVID-19 today and what it means, what's happening with Frederick Bertley. He's president and CEO of COSI, but he also holds a PhD in immunology and worked internationally in preventative medicine and basic vaccines. We're talking about that. If you have a question or comment for Frederick Bertley, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. There are lines open right now, and we'll get to the calls that are waiting as well. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for the All Sides with Ann Fisher podcast comes from Wolf's Ridge Brewing, a family-owned Columbus brewery and restaurant, offering home beer delivery and curbside food pickup Tuesday through Sunday. More at wolfsridgebrewing.com.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. President Trump's COVID-19 diagnosis focused attention on testing and treatments and the impact of so-called super spreader events. Frederick Bertley is with us to talk about all of that. He's president and CEO of COSI. He also is an immunologist. He worked internationally in preventative medicine and basic vaccines, and he helped develop DNA vaccines for HIV/AIDS at Harvard Medical School. 614-292-8513 is the number to call, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. That ceremony where he announced his nominee to the U.S. Supreme Court was practically, it was like an ideal model of how to spread the disease, it seemed like, Frederick Bertley.
I mean, absolutely. I mean, you saw the staggering numbers, roughly 36 high officials from the White House now.
That we know of, yeah.
That we know of got infected, and you know, they all presume it happened from that event. They're calling the super spreader. And it's, it, you know, on the one hand, it's terrible that it happened. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, it's a clear validating experiment of what the scientists and healthcare officials have been saying for the longest while. Don't do these things, you know, and if you do them, to have that social distance and wear a mask. And that's a direct consequence of what happened. And our president got infected and was measured positive.
And so did a bunch of other people.
And a bunch of other people, absolutely.
Let's see. Abdul in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Abdul.
Hi, thank you, Anne. Thank you for taking my call. I appreciate it. I like your show.
Thank you.
My question is, I got two questions. Like, let's follow up your last thing you say about that super spreader. We know there's a lot of people walking around the country and the world. We don't know if they got it, even themselves or the doctors, they got it, like they are like an immune system. And we open the schools now. And then and the kids, you know, they touch everywhere. They do anything they want. Well, yeah, I want to know what those people, how could they combine us? Even myself or yourself, you got the disease and you don't got any symptoms, no headache, no fever, no nothing showing up, the usual symptoms. And what were the governments doing and what we can learn about that? And the second thing, it is, yesterday we hit Ohio, the highest number we even have for the pandemic, almost was around 2,000. And we opened the schools, like we say in the super spreader, that could be the start of the government and the health professionals should have caution about that. Let's wait till we learn this thing after the holiday or after that. Because yesterday I heard it was like 2,000 people got infected in
Ohio. Well, it was reported, yeah.
Yeah, and that was the highest number we ever heard it. And next week we're going to be opening Columbus School, one of the biggest schools in Franklin area. Right. And I think that's a super disaster. See what happened, like one event of the White House, 84 mm-hmm. people got it. Imagine when you bring 200 people and then those 200 people, they go to their houses, their families.
Right.
That's my question. I thank you. I appreciate it.
Okay, Abdul. Thank you. All right. So what if you have symptoms? I mean, it's kind of this age old since March question about how do I know if I have it and how do I know if I'm spreading it if I don't have symptoms?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough question, right? I mean, it's hard to say what to do in the unknown. But if you think you were exposed or you know you were exposed to somebody, you know, you need to, you know, the drill, we need to quarantine ourselves, and that's staying away from, you know, from folks for 14 days. If you got tested and you're positive, but you have no symptoms, it can be many things. You got tested very early, So the symptoms kick in roughly 4 or 5 days after you get exposed. So your first few days, you might not have any symptoms, and so you don't know, right? And so you just have to, if you get tested and you're positive, but you feel great, one, make sure you're monitoring yourself daily because you may start not feeling great. But if you're out to 10 to 14 days of feeling great, you're then deemed asymptomatic, but you still have the virus and you can still spread it. So you should be in quarantine. No exceptions. If you are positive with the infection, you should remove yourself from exposure to other individuals.
If you know you have it.
If you know you have it. If you don't know you have it, again, you just got to rely on, well, did I go to a cookout? Mm-hmm. You know, and when I went to that cookout, I still feel good. But, you know, somebody, Timothy or Jane, was deemed positive at a cookout. Mm-hmm. Then you need to immediately get yourself tested and then go from there. Now, if you've been in your house and you haven't gone anywhere, there's no reason for you to presume that you've contacted COVID.
Okay, Abdul, thanks for those questions. Let's see. Jim in Delaware, you're on the air. Hi, Jim.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I guess I have more of a comment than a question, but my comment is when we talk about super spreaders and all that stuff, I mean, basically, who cares? It's out, in my opinion, it's out there. So I think what we're concerned about is the death rate, and it seems to be somewhat more aggressive than the regular flu, just because we don't have the immune response to it that we would have for ones we've been exposed to previously. But I mean, it's out there now; it's been released. So let's just roll with it.
Okay.
You know, why the big panic?
All right. Well, then let's ask Frederick Bertley. I'm one point, as Jim described it, it's somewhat more aggressive than flu. What's your understanding about if you want to compare it to the flu? Again, there's all kinds of strains of flu, but be that as it may, what do you make of that description?
Yeah, well, so a couple of things. The flu has been around forever, and we've had vaccines for the flu forever. So we've managed to squash that. We have episodes, you know, Spanish flu and other flu outbreaks when we didn't have a vaccine, and you can see how devastating that was. In the context here, there is a little bit of good news. And the good news is, even though our infections are rising throughout Ohio and throughout much of the U.S. and in Europe, the death rates aren't rising as fast. And the reason why that's happening is, as you said at the beginning of the show, Anne, you know, the medical community and the healthcare community knows a lot more now than before. So while we don't have a cure, we have some good treatments that are helping. We understand best practices in the hospital. So the deaths, not that we're out of the woods by any stretch, but the death toll isn't rising with the same rapidity that it was before.
So why not just let it spread then?
Pardon me?
Why not, as Jim asked, why not just let it run its course?
Because A, you can get very sick, and B, you can die. I didn't want to be clear. I did not say mortality is no longer happening. It's just not happening at the same rate. Uh-huh. Remember, I mean, we have a ridiculous number of deaths in this country. We've never seen this in any time of our life period. So it's not as simple as just saying it's out there. You know, let us get used to it, Jim, and let it level set and, oh, it kills off some people. We have to really continue to control the spread of it, because sickness isn't great and death certainly is not acceptable. So it's not okay to let it go. Now, when we fast forward to the vaccines, that'll significantly help. And then, Jim, it'll probably become like the flu, where there will be still some people who might get sick and there will be still some people who will die every year from coronavirus, but we can't accept the levels that are happening right now. And all you have to do is speak to anybody whose family has been really impacted by that, and you'll hear from them that they want us to continue to research and figure out how to cull this infection back.
Okay. Jim, thanks a lot for that question. Let's see. Mike, you're on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Hi, Mike.
Hi. This morning on the Today program, I didn't catch the whole thing. O, people with blood types O, have less severe reactions. People with AB have more severe reactions. Do you have any comment on that, or do you know anything about what they were talking about?
Yeah, I mean, there's this whole kind of healthcare field that looks at blood types in general. So whether you're A, AB, O, and, you know, how health how healthy you are and your fitness and your susceptibility to different things, whether that's obesity, whether that's, you know, diabetes, whether that's infection rates. So that's a field that's been studied and looked at for a long time. And now people are starting to analyze that in context with coronavirus infection, how fast they clear it, how fast they progress to disease, and how fast they progress, unfortunately, to mortality if that happens. So I'm not going to comment on it yet because it's a very fluid thing, but do know that people have been studying blood types and what that means for you and how you might be susceptible to one thing or more or another based on your blood type. It's not a guarantee by any stretch. It doesn't mean if you're type A, it means this, or you're type B, it means that. But people have always been looking at that. And now that's what you were hearing earlier this morning.
All right, Mike, thanks for that question. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. And my guest is Frederick Bertley, president and CEO of COSI. He holds a PhD in immunology, has worked internationally in preventative medicine and basic vaccines. And he's joined us a couple times already since March to talk about COVID-19. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. We have an email from Marla. She says, I'm a healthcare worker, and I've been told by other healthcare workers across the state that even if you've been exposed or tested positive, as long as you are asymptomatic, there is no need to get tested and that you need to come back to work. The employer gets to make the decision. Is there a statewide policy or just recommendation? Dr. Bertley, can you respond to that?
Yeah, so I think it's just a recommendation at this point. But in terms of, you have a personal choice. If you're asymptomatic, you don't have to get tested. But if you're a healthcare worker and you're asymptomatic, you should want to know if you're positive. And the reason why is you are on the front lines, and bless you for being on the front lines, but you're on the front lines. And so just because you feel asymptomatic, but if you're carrying it, you will be infectious and you could spread it. So, you know, if you're asymptomatic, but you're staying at home for 14 days, no, you don't need to get tested. But if you're a healthcare worker, or if you're on the front lines, or if you're a classroom teacher, if you're any place where you're in front of a lot of people, mm-hmm. you know, and you're asymptomatic, but you know you were exposed, you should get tested because, again, Marla, a person can spread the virus even if they have no symptoms at all.
Okay, let's see. Brad in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Brad.
Hello. Hello, doctor. Hello, Ann.
Hi.
First question, if one gets a coronavirus vaccine that is 50% effective, and then months later, another coronavirus vaccine, different company comes out that is 70 or 80% effective. Can you get the second one, and can it be additive to the first one in terms of protection? Question number two about vaccines is I have a very good chiropractor friend who is he's an anti-vaxxer, and he continually puts down getting a flu vaccine. And I would like Dr. Burley to speak to the public about the importance of getting the flu vaccine, especially now during the fall and during the pandemic.
Yeah, so to your first question, which is a great question, if you get a vaccine, let's say we get a corona vaccine on day X, you take it, it protects you at the 50% level, and then 3 months later, there's another vaccine that comes out and it may protect you at a higher level. A, should you take it? And then B, if you do take it, are you going to be better protected? So the short answer is we're going to know all of that in 1, 2, 3, 4 years. But if you want kind of a scientific hypothesis, is if you take a vaccine and it protects you at X level, and then you take another vaccine, you might want to take the same vaccine that you took the first time because that could be a booster. And that's what happens with kids. When we give measles, mumps, rubella, for example, you get it on X day. Then a few months later, you get your second dose. Then a few years later, you get your third dose, right? But it's the same dose. It's the same vaccine. And you're boosting it. You're building it up higher and higher each time you get the injection. If you take one vaccine and take a completely different vaccine, because we haven't done this yet, it'll be interesting to see what will happen. You might get, as you said, an associated aggregate better immunologic coverage, or the second vaccine might just cover you at 70% and that's your new coverage. There's also the possibility that the first vaccine might interfere with a little bit of the efficacy or how good that second vaccine would be. So we don't know right away, but I can assure you, if we have 3 or 4 or 5 really great vaccine candidates, that's going to be a great thing because with time, we'll know which ones are the best ones to provide you the longest type of immunity. In terms of the question about taking the flu shot and should you not take it. The recommendation is that you definitely take the flu shot. And in particular, in this season of flu combining with coronavirus, you know, it could be a perfect storm. So the more people who are vaccinated and the more people who are protected from getting the flu, that will help diminish the flu, of course, which will maintain strength in that population. So hopefully when they get exposed, if unfortunately they get exposed to coronavirus, their immune system will be healthy and strong enough to kind of fight through that as well. So I would follow the healthcare recommendations, get your flu shots. I hear you on your colleague who's an anti-vaccinator. You know, that for me is like, you know, my analogy, and I'm not going to, yes, I could go into my oven, take out the hot pot without using oven mitts. I'm going to put on oven mitts. Why am I going to take that chance?
Brad, thanks a lot for that question. Is it in the future plausible that they could combine like a COVID-19 vaccine with the flu vaccine every year?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. So we do that. We have diphtheria, pertussis, and tetanus, DPT. Those are given. Those are three different infection agents, and they're given together. We have measles, mumps, rubella. They're also given together. So you could have possibly a flu and a coronavirus. I don't know how well it's going to pan out, because the one thing we know about the flu is that virus mutates every year.
Okay.
And while we know coronavirus, there's all these kind of submutations that are happening. We're not sure the coronavirus vaccine, when it comes out, it might be like measles and give you 60 years of immunoprotection, mm-hmm. right? Or maybe it might be like the flu, where each year or each season you need another vaccine. We just don't know that yet. So when we find all of that out, you might see situations where it might be complementary and you combine it with the flu vaccine, or it might be church and state, keep them separate.
Let's see. Mike in Columbus, you wanted to reply to the fellow out of Delaware who asked, why don't we just let it run its course?
Yeah, I did. And thanks for taking my comment here.
Sure.
So gentleman there was talking about, you know, there's no reason to, why don't we just stop panicking and kind of let it do its thing. And I think he was getting a little bit deeper in just terms of like the fear that we have around this. And I mean, the thing that assumption I've been operating under for the whole time is obviously masks prevent the transmission of the disease at a high rate, right? So it's very easy to put one on. I mean, I think the thing that I see that's just so baffling is that folks are just refusing to use masks. And mm-hmm. so kind of like the oven mitt analogy, you would never grab a hot pan from the oven without an oven mitt. You would never get in the car without putting your seatbelt on. You don't ride a motorcycle without a helmet, right?
So well, some people do, but yeah, go ahead.
if you actually care about your health, you take steps to protect it, and no one's cutting their seatbelts out of their cars, mm-hmm. you know, because they, you know, they're, you know, objecting to it. So, I mean, to me, this is an image thing. You've got a bunch of people who are concerned about their image. They're trying to look macho or not look weak. And really, if you look back at the White House event that you mentioned before, if those folks would have had masks on, I don't think you'd have seen very many, if any, infections here, even if there were people that, you know, may have had, you know, trace of the virus. It's a very effective tool to stop the spread.
Mm-hmm.
So very disappointing, and it just shows how immature people are. And I don't know. I can't understand it. I'd be interested to hear a little bit more about the psychology behind why people aren't doing that, you know?
Okay. Well, Mike, thanks.
Mike, I do want to comment on your motorcycle helmet analogy and the seatbelt analogy. Mm-hmm. And you're right, some people still, you know, opt to ride a motorcycle and not wear a helmet. Mm-hmm. But the data is clear. If you ride a motorcycle and wear a helmet and ride a motorcycle and don't wear a helmet, the injuries in the head injuries and the traumatic injuries and deaths in the people who don't wear a motorcycle helmet are much more. Same thing with the seatbelt. Now, the seatbelt's different, you know. You get a ticket if you don't wear your seatbelt in most states. But the data is clear. You might not put on your seatbelt, but if you get into an accident and you were wearing your seatbelt versus not wearing the seatbelt, there's a significantly increased chance of injury and death if you weren't wearing the seatbelt. So, Mike, you're spot on. Just put on the seatbelt. Wear the motorcycle helmet and wear your mask.
Thank you, Mike, for that call. We will have more lines open, so give us a call if you have a question about the virus, about the vaccines that are in production or not in production yet, but in being studied. My guest is Frederick Bertley, president and CEO of COSAI, also an immunologist. He's worked internationally in preventative medicine and basic vaccines. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. We're talking about COVID-19 today with immunologist Frederick Bertley. You also know him as president and CEO of COSAI. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Frederick Bertley, I wanted to talk about the vaccine development progress. I mean, they've been working at unprecedented pace, but there are the typical setbacks. You can't. It's science. It's not a for sure thing yet.
Absolutely. I mean, a few things. One, we are working at unprecedented rates to develop a vaccine. One of the reasons why we're able to do, well, first of all, the need to do that is because we are in the middle of a pandemic and it's out of control. So we have to control it. But it's important to understand there are a sequence of steps and it normally takes X number of years. They usually talk about, 4 to 7 year window to develop a safe vaccine. One of the reasons why we were able to jumpstart this process is because we weren't starting from ground zero. We had other vaccine candidates related to SARS-based viruses that we actually used. So it wasn't like we were starting from ground zero like we did with HIV. So that's one, just so that people feel a little more comfortable. It's not like they're completely shortchanging the whole process. Having said that, to your point, Anne, it takes time and it's a scientific process to collect the data. And so we have a whole bunch of vaccines in clinical phases. I think we're up to 45 different vaccine clinical trials. And by clinical trials, that means they are now trying them in humans from phase 1 to phase 3. And we have 6 candidates that actually have limited approval. This is in China and Russia. They have not been approved officially for world use or anything like that. But it is a process. It takes time. And as you mentioned, sometimes there's setbacks. You heard different companies here and there pulled or stopped their vaccine trials. Now, when you hear that, it's important to understand it doesn't mean that, oh my gosh, Rome fell and things are completely out of control. It's that the scientists and physicians are literally looking at everything. And if they see anything that's slightly wonky or there's a little adverse effect here or there, instead of taking the chance of just continuing forward and flying through, they'll pause, they'll collect the data, and then they'll move on. And we've seen that happen already, and we're continuing to see that happen a little bit here. But we will get a vaccine at some point that will be safe and effective, and the FDA will not approve a vaccine if it is not safe and effective based on what our standards are.
Okay. Let's see. Linda emailed us. She said she's actually has several questions. I'll try to get to them. She asks, is there any evidence of the genetic differences between the two strains of COVID that have been identified so far?
There's evidence of genetic differences in terms of the strains. There's not yet evidence as to lethality in one strain is much worse than the other yet. Again, in about 2 to 4 years, we'll find out if there's some mild forms of coronavirus or some more insidious forms of coronavirus. We're not there yet, but we just know that these strains are mutating, and time will tell if there's a variation that's that much worse.
And she asks further if scientists have been able to collect and save the strain that caused the first infection and then the second for comparison. I would imagine they're going to try to save every strain they can.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, the way you know that they mutate is you compare back to that original strain, for example, and that's how you know, oh, the genetic sequence is slightly different. And what's that new sequence? Here's what it is. And then you might get a third one and you compare that to the next, the first two, et cetera. So the way you know the genetic variance is always by comparing it to a precursor version. And that's where you identify if and where the difference is.
And she also asks whether physicians have been able to examine the immune systems of the individuals showing reinfection. Do they have immune systems that are compromised in any way?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's being looked at it right now. Unfortunately, we don't have a ton of those people who are reinfected. As you mentioned, Anne, in the U.S., we finally had our first case. Europe had theirs a few weeks ago. So unfortunately, Linda, we don't have, hundreds, let alone thousands of people to study yet. But you bet that's exactly what they're going to be looking at and comparing, what was it about their immune system that's different from someone, for example, who got sick but then recovered, and then compare them to someone who got infected but was asymptomatic. Are they immunologic differences there? And can we say, oh, the people who are asymptomatic have these kind of antibodies or these kind of T cells responding, that's why they're protected versus the other one. So we don't know yet, but yes, those are great things that are going to be tested for sure by scientists and physicians.
Okay, let's see. Michelle in Reynoldsburg, you're on the air. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, how are you, Ann?
Good, thank you.
Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I had a question for the doctor. I've been closely watching the cases rising like everyone else over the last week and a half or so. And I'm very concerned about the fact that schools, a lot of them are going to be reopening Monday in a hybrid fashion, which, you know, would still be, the children would be there 2 days a week, probably. Some I know are going to go full in person next week. And I would like to know, doctor, if you were advising the superintendents, how do you feel about this? And what would your advice be?
Okay, yeah, I think, Dr. Burtley, how do you feel about this is one thing, but what do you advise them and how to proceed if they're going to open up schools?
Yeah, so thank you for teasing those apart. You know, how do I feel about it versus the advice? I'm not on those boards. I'm not making those decisions, unfortunately, or fortunately, because they're truly tough decisions. What I will say is if they're choosing to open, they have to ensure with the best possible capacity that they're providing a safe environment for the kids, for the teachers, and for any of the workers in these schools. If they think that they can, based on what we now know about how this virus transmits, et cetera, if they can guarantee that they can provide this safe space, they have to do that. Should they be opening schools up entirely? You know, that's a different question. And we chatted a little bit about that at the beginning of the show, and Michelle, it's just a tough call. But if these people who are making the decisions, superintendents or whoever, don't feel like they can provide a safe environment, then they shouldn't open. But if you know you can provide a safe environment, or at least with the best practices, believe you can provide a safe environment, then at least ensure that you're doing that. That's how I'll answer that question. But Michelle, it's a great question, and it's a tough question, and it just speaks to how serious what's happening is to us, and why, you know, we can't just, you know, one of our callers said, kind of just let it go, even though we're all frustrated that it's impacting our lives. We have to still try to be smart about it.
Thanks, Michelle, for that question. I'm going to turn now to Amy in Granville. You're on the air. Amy, hi.
Is it Wendy or Amy?
Wendy,
sorry.
Okay.
I have a question about the N95 mask.
Yeah.
I use my cloth mask for normal use, but if I'm going into hospital or a test at a doctor's office, I will wear my N95. If I use that once, don't use it again for 3 or 4 weeks, can this be used for long term?
That's a great question. That one I'll have to do my research and get back to you, because the mask thing is, again, I go back to, sorry to sound like a broken record, Anne, but I go back to the oven mitts. Analogy. There are different kinds of oven mitts. They're rubber oven mitts. They're, you know, thick oven mitts, thin oven mitts. They all work to protect your hands at some level. Some work better than others. How do you wash those after you use them? How do you treat them after you use them? Again, they respond differently in your washing machine versus washing my hand, and, you know, et cetera. So same thing with the mask. I don't want to specifically on air say right now, you know, how much time you can reuse an M95 mask or not, but an M95 mask is definitively better than the non-N95 mask, for example. So if you have access to those, do use those. But any mask is better than no mask.
So, all right. So I use a KN95. You know, personally pay for them. They're expensive, but not that expensive. You know, it's all relative, of course, expenses. And I wear them to work out in group workout. I'm the only person who does it. I'm doing that to protect me. I mean, I'm glad if it keeps me from infecting anybody else out there, but I use them to protect me, right?
I mean, it's tricky, right? The science of the mask is if you are infected, While you can touch something and put virus there, we now know definitively that the lion's share of transmission happens by spreading from the mouth, mm-hmm. right? Aerosolated, out talking, you know, a little bit of saliva that comes out that you don't see it, but it's out there when you talk, right? So the main rationale for the mask is it prevents the spread from you as an infected individual from spreading it to someone else, mm-hmm. right? Okay, now, the other thing we know is the main route to infection is through your mouth and nose, which is why they tell you try not to touch your nose and mouth and wash your hands often, right? And so by wearing a mask consistently, you're just by definition not touching your mouth and nose as much because you've got a physical barrier there. So that way it does help protect you from getting infected as well. But the rationale is most importantly to prevent you from spreading it.
Okay.
And what's amazing is if everybody has a mask on, you know, when they're outside their home or at least in contact with anybody, if the globe had a mask on, and one of the callers hinted to this, and some people were infected, it's that much harder to spread it because you have this mask on. And so that's why it's so important. But, you know, but back to your call, Wendy, you know, the idea of washing masks and M95 and how long it will last, you know, frankly, I would go to the website and check the details about the mask and see what they recommend. I'll do some digging myself because I'm really curious, but that's a great mask. Wear it. And it's much better than not wearing a mask for sure.
Right. Okay, Wendy, thanks for that. Let's see. Susan in Hillsborough, you're on the air. Hi, Susan.
Hi, how are you today?
Good, thanks.
Good. You've really just touched on the point that I was going to make. I feel that the analogy with the motorcycle helmet or the seatbelt is about an individual making a choice to protect themselves. When you wear a mask, you're making a choice to protect others.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really not this issue of I've made the decision that I'm not going to worry about COVID and I'm not going to wear my mask. It's more about a response to others wearing a mask. And I really think that that analogy is closer to driving while drunk than it is about, you know, riding a motorcycle without a helmet, because you're making a choice to put others at risk.
Okay.
Absolutely, Susan. That's a great point. I couldn't agree with you more.
Susan, thanks for that call. Let's see, Joe in Worthington, you're on the air. Hi, Joe.
Hey, hey. So I was hearing some of the conversation about the N95 mask.
Uh-huh.
I work industrial construction, and we use them. We've always used them. They're designed, I mean, they can actually stop things like concrete dust for a 6 to 8 to 12 hour period. So when somebody says, can I reuse it again, in light use, just for, say, COVID protection,
uh-huh.
they can be reused many times for that, as long as they're kept clean and, say, you put them in a Ziploc bag or something when you're finished with them.
Right.
And they are expensive because, you know, I mean, a lot of people can't afford to buy 20 or 30 things. So, yes, they can be reused quite a bit, actually.
Well, that's, I mean, I'm not absolutely sure. I mean, I believe you, Joe, and I'm thinking that makes about right. Because I'm not constantly wearing my mask. I just wear it when I'm around other people and when I, you know, go to work out or something like that, Frederick Bertley, right? I mean, so that kind of makes sense.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. I think, thank you for that, Joe. I think Wendy's question was about washing it. So to your point about the concrete.
You can't wash an N95.
Well, exactly. So the question was, is there a way to basically recycle it? And I didn't have the answer to that.
Yeah, I see. Okay. Joe, thanks for that call. We're just about out of time, but the White House has reportedly embraced a declaration by a group of scientists advocating a strategy of herd immunity. And you cannot achieve herd immunity until you have enough people who are vaccinated or immune, right?
Absolutely. And the other most important thing is, we don't know what level of protection we need to have herd immunity. Herd immunity is a concept. It means there's enough people who are protected against infectious agent X that the likelihood of you meeting a positive person, meaning you meeting someone who is infected with, you know, bug X, is a really low probability. but it depends on the agents. It's not a specific number that it's 75% for Ebola and measles and HIV. It really depends. And because coronavirus is brand new, we don't know what it is. So we're guesstimating a high level of herd immunity, probably in the low 90s to mid 90s is where we're going to aim for it first. But we'll find out over time what that magic number is.
Frederick Burtley, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Always a pleasure. I look forward to chatting with you again.
Thank you. Frederick Burtley, president and CEO of COSI. He's also a PhD in immunology and worked internationally in preventative medicine and basic vaccines. Just so you get the latest, the number of total cases in Ohio, 173,665 as of yesterday. And nationally, almost 8 million cases now. And then deaths in Ohio, 5,033. And nationally, 216,872, according to Johns Hopkins. Thanks for listening. Have a great day. Thanks to our All-Side staff, too. Producer Aaron Esmont, producer Matt Rand, our assistant producer, Bobby Gerberick, with video production by Nick Payne, board operation by Herb Hauenstein and Scott Good. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Thanks again for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Thank you.